50 years ago today, the United States celebrated its first ever Earth Day.
Following a green and white mock-up of the American flag to the Washington Monument grounds, the 2,000 original marchers had swelled to perhaps 10,000 or more by nightfall.
That sound from ABC News in 1970, when the news station reported on Earth Day celebrations across the country.
Of all the environmental plagues they were protesting.
This episode of Borrowed, we're going to be taking us back to 1970. The world has just seen itself in a picture for the first time, taken from the Apollo 8 mission in 1968.
Back here on Earth, the environmental movement was starting to take off. So Rachel Carson had published her seminal book, Silent Spring, in 1962, which revealed just how dangerous chemicals like DDT and other pesticides were for the living environment. People across the country were becoming aware of how damaging air pollution from cars and factories were for public health and the health of our planet. On that first Earth Day in 1970, the estimates are that 20 million people took part across the country with marches and demonstrations and teach-ins. In Boston, students staged a die-in at Logan Airport to protest the pollution being created by air travel. In California, an environmental group marched from Sacramento all the way to LA, and it took 6 weeks.
In New York City, for that first Earth Day, Mayor John Lindsay shut down Fifth Avenue, from 59th Street all the way to 14th Street. And Union Square became the terminus and center of the New York City Earth Day celebration.
And right here in Brooklyn, Prospect Park was shut down to cars, and that's back when cars could still drive the whole length of it. The governor of New York at the time, Governor Rockefeller, took a bike ride through Prospect Park to promote green transportations, and he had photographers and radio reporters in tow.
In Manhattan, the demonstrations were attended by over 100,000 people throughout the city. One speaker after another took to the steps of the New York Public Library in Manhattan. Mayor John Lindsay spoke to the crowd, and we're going to play a little of what he said that day. This audio comes to us from WNYC Archives.
New York City was quite beautiful today, and yet, oddly enough, the more beautiful it can look on an occasion like this, the more we are reminded that the business of pollution is the twin brother of the business of poverty and despair.
Earth Day back in 1970 was framed a little differently, I think, than we think of the environmental movement today. A lot of the focus, pretty broadly, was this idea that it was a personal responsibility, that we should clean up our litter and everyone needs to do their part.
And that contribution and commitment goes all the way from the business of taking on each person's shoulders the responsibility for stopping the littering, for ending the attitude and the indifference, the respect for alternate side parking regulations, and simple housekeeping matters of this kind.
I like how alternate side parking was a problem 50 years ago, and it's a problem today.
Yeah, that's what people say, right? But Mayor Lindsay also made sure to call for bigger, more structural changes to save the earth.
I do think that we therefore have a right to call upon our national leaders as well as ourselves to stop the insanity of the use of our resources towards the military-industrial complex in this country. And I think, too, that we have a right to ask that the industrial might and technical know-how of America, by carrot-and-stick systems, by laws, by persuasion, by cooperation, be turned towards the business of the saving of our environment.
You heard Mayor Lindsay there mention the military-industrial complex, and that's because in 1970, America was in the middle of the Vietnam War, which was incredibly unpopular and a deadly conflict. And for a lot of people in 1970, it felt like end times. So these calls for environmental justice and for peace were urgent and passionate.
But of course, it wasn't the end of times. Here we are, 50 years later, very much still facing an environmental crisis. And Earth Day is here again.
But instead of the Vietnam War, we are now battling the coronavirus pandemic.
So we're going to take the opportunity here on Borrowed to look back to the first Earth Day and asks what that means for us today. I'm Adjoa Duse.
And I'm Krissa Corbett-Kavouris. You're listening to Borrowed, stories that start at the library.
Before we go any further, I do want to point out that our voices might still sound a bit strange, and that's because here in New York, we're still on lockdown, and Krissa and I are recording from our separate apartments.
That's right, but we are no less thrilled to be bringing you our latest Borrowed episode. We are still here for you remotely, and we hope you're all doing okay.
So, to get back to Earth Day, another speech on April 22nd in 1970 that resonated with us when we were doing our research on the first Earth Day was from Margaret Mead, the anthropologist made famous by her studies of Samoan culture. Professor Mead was teaching at Columbia at the time, and she spoke to a crowd at the Natural History Museum. Here's sound from that speech. It's a little fuzzy, but it's also courtesy of WNYC Archives.
Dr. Mead, I'd just like to ask you this. In your own opinion, how would you characterize the present danger that we face in this country right now today?
Well, we face killing lake by lake, stream by stream, estuary by estuary, all our waters where our fish breed, and we face our cities strangling themselves in waste, in decayed schools, deteriorated buildings.
Dr. Mead's outlook was very grim in that speech in 1970, and today, I don't think she'd love to know that the state of the environment is, in fact, even grimmer. The Union of Concerned Scientists is predicting that by the end of the 21st century, 100 million people will be displaced by sea level rise, and 800 million people who live in poverty will go hungry because of damage to crops. And according to the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in order to prevent the worst of the impacts of climate change, we have to keep the global temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. And doing that requires the world to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. So on the 80th anniversary of Earth Day, in 30 years, every society on our planet has to make drastic changes to the way we live.
Even in 1970, people were thinking about what a future impacted by climate crisis would look like. Here's another journalist questioning Margaret Mead.
Do you have some people will say a specific date in the future. If corrective measures are not taken by then, man will not survive.
We don't know that much. I mean, there are people who say in 20 years the Earth will begin to be uninhabitable. I should say it's begun to be uninhabitable in many places right now.
Including New York?
Well, New York is one of the least habitable cities. Place I prefer to live, but I can't think why.
I see what you did there, Margaret. Margaret Mead just made a joke there about New York being uninhabitable. But I think this is a good place to mention that social and economic inequality really determine who is impacted by climate change. Here in the West, we tend not to see what we don't want to see. But over this 50-year span, there are lots of, quote, uninhabitable spaces where people have no choice but to live and stay.
Exactly. And it gets closer to home, too. Social and economic inequality impacts people's susceptibility to environmental disasters, even right here in Brooklyn. Greenpoint, which of course is now such a trendy place to live, was actually a very working class neighborhood in the middle of the 20th century, and it was the site of one of the largest oil spills in the United States. It destroyed the natural environment there and endangered human health. And as we learned with Superstorm Sandy, Brooklyn neighborhoods that have been historically disinvested, like Coney Island and Red Hook, took years to recover from the impact of that storm. We've got Borrowed episodes about both of those moments in history, and we'll put links to those in the show notes so that you can listen back.
So to return to the question that the journalist asked Margaret Mead 50 years ago, how long until we start seeing the worst of the environmental degradation? It's a scary question, and for many communities, it's already too late to reverse climate change. Scientists still don't know, and that fear and uncertainty can paralyze us. So we were listening pretty closely when Dr. Mead was asked this next question.
What areas do you see for optimism, Dr. Mead?
Well, man has solved many, many problems in the past. We've learned to set ourselves a problem and solve it. And there's no reason why we can't do it. We have the tools, we have the computers, but without them, I hate to think what we do with it. But we've got everything now, except the political and moral will.
It may have been a little bit hard to hear at the end of that tape there, but it bears repeating. Dr. Mead said, quote, "We've got everything now, except the political and moral will." And that feels pretty consistent with the situation we're in today. We still do have the tools and the intelligence to solve this problem. We just lack this idea of political and moral will as a nation to act aggressively and not let up on fixing climate change.
From an individual standpoint, this is still a really important question. What gives us hope? So a few months ago, Brooklyn Public Library collaborated with two other library systems, Mill Valley Public Library in California and Austin Public Library in Texas, and asked similar questions to the ones that Margaret Mead was asked 50 years ago. The first question was, what motivates you to act on climate change? And the second question was, what gives you hope?
So let's hear some answers to that first question.
What motivates you to act on climate change?
My children and my grandchild, and the fact that I got to grow up in such a beautiful area, and I don't want to see the destruction and it made impossible for people to enjoy life as much as I've enjoyed life.
I'm motivated by the richness and uniqueness of planet Earth. While there may be life on other planets, we haven't found it yet, and it may not resemble anything we've ever known. Humans are just one of myriad species on this planet, and we no more deserve it than does every other creature.
Terror, honestly. I guess maybe some people do, but I don't come to activism because I enjoy it or because it's fun. I do it because I can't stand to think about, like, the idea of not acting when the crisis is so severe.
Since becoming pregnant, I feel a greater sense of urgency and commitment with acting on climate change. I question and wonder, what will my daughter inherit?
That was Glenda Sharp from Mill Valley, California, Kate Abel from Austin, Texas, Susan Augenbraun from right here in Brooklyn, and Christina Shin from Austin again.
At Brooklyn Public Library, our producer Virginia visited an event at Central hosted by 350 Brooklyn, the local chapter of a national environmental action organization. That event was part of a monthly series on climate change that has been happening at the library for a while. And although all events at the library have stopped because of the coronavirus pandemic, that particular panel back in February was pretty relevant to today's episode because it was all about how climate change impacts public health. Nurses from the New York State Nurses Association and a public health professional spoke about the illnesses that are caused by environmental pollution, illnesses such as asthma, cancer, and heat stroke. Here's Denise Patel, who moderated the discussion. She's a public health professional who works at Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives.
I was working in New Jersey when Superstorm Sandy hit. Superstorm Sandy really gave me the impetus to look at the health impacts of climate change. And when I started doing that, I learned about all of the other ways that climate change is going to be impacting our health. Everything from the disasters that we see in the news to crop devastation to the increases of allergies because of prolonged warmer seasons, the spread of infectious diseases.
What really motivated me was going to honor medical missions.
That last voice was Dora Acevedo, a nurse practitioner at Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx.
I've been to Puerto Rico right after Maria. I've been to the Philippines 2 years after Typhoon Haiyan. You know, and you see the devastation. It's like, and these are storms that were mega storms. And then just seeing the changes, particularly where I live, because I live around trees and grass. plants are blooming sooner. The animals are acting differently. It just makes you more scared. And then now these new viruses are coming out, you know.
That virus she's mentioning there at the end, that was COVID-19. Back in February, when we collected these interviews, the virus was just beginning to shut down whole provinces in China.
At the panel, Dora talked about how rising temperatures and global climate change impacts all organisms, including vectors or transmitters of viruses like mosquitoes, bats, and ticks. She pointed out that as our climate continues to change, it's hard to predict how it will impact the spread of diseases. As of now, there is no evidence that climate change increased the spread of COVID-19, but we do know that other diseases like malaria and yellow fever, which are usually confined to areas with high average temperatures, have been spreading to new places as environments heat up.
And there have been a few articles written recently comparing the threat of climate change to the current pandemic, making the point that as disruptive as this current health crisis has been, the impacts that climate change will have are going to be even more disruptive if we continue on this path. Right now, nurses like Dora are on the front lines of fighting the COVID-19 pandemic in the Bronx. But months earlier, she was already making that connection between the health of her community and the climate crisis.
It's strange to go back even just 2 months to the lead up to Earth Day 2020. Before the coronavirus pandemic, students and environmental activists were planning massive strikes for Earth Day. Marches were being planned for New York City to recapture some of the urgency and energy of the first Earth Day back in 1970, when New Yorkers took to the streets.
Now, those strikes have gone digital. We'll put links on our webpage to some of the ways that you can participate in the global action on Earth Day this year.
And since we can't gather in big crowds, we wanted to crowdsource some nature sounds from around Brooklyn and farther afield. We asked people to open their doors and record their environment to leave us all with a little bit more hope. We asked that last question that was posed to Margaret Mead 50 years ago on the first Earth Day. What areas do you see for optimism? Or simply put, what gives you hope?
What most gives me hope is seeing the growth of the climate movement, seeing the increased awareness among the general public of the climate crisis, catastrophe, emergency.
I am sitting on my stoop in Clinton Hill, and there is a bumblebee crawling into a crack in front of me. The streets have been relatively clear recently because everyone's staying inside, which means that there's more sounds of nature around.
Oh, I hate to say this, but I don't have a lot of hope. I tend to, it's not that I always try to see the worst. It's just I've seen example of, you know, people trying to do better and just getting thwarted at every turn, and I don't have a lot of hope. That's really sad, but it doesn't stop me from trying.
I'm sitting in this triangular garden space in the northeast corner of Sunset Park, the park itself, after which the neighborhood is named. And since the pandemic and since the social distancing and lockdown measures that the state has taken, this has become kind of as far afield as I'll bring my son once or twice a week, just to get a little nature, just to get a little grass and peer at wood chip piles and look for ants. He has noticed, and we have noticed, though, the minute changes in the vegetation here in this garden in the way that I probably wouldn't have in other springs, because I'm just walking past it and kind of normally I'm just looking and saying, oh, the daffodils are out. But now that I've been in this triangle of garden for, you know, twice a week or so for a month, I'm noticing different plants and when they're blooming.
You know, what gives me hope is that there are many, many people out there, young people. They give me hope because they're speaking up. They're doing things. My generation is not doing anything. They're just very complacent and very much involved with their own material existence.
I think the optimism of young people like little children who plant a tree and or, you know, see a flower and get excited, and they're not so jaded. You know, they pause and look at things like that. And so that gives me hope that we can turn this around.
That was Mimi Bluestone from Brooklyn, Jennifer, Tula, and Sarah from Mill Valley, with narration and nature sounds from Sarah Ivory in Salisbury, Connecticut, and from our producer, Virginia and Krissa, all in Brooklyn.
And now it's time for our book match segment. Virginia spoke with Margaret Day, who put together a list of book recommendations for Earth Day.
Margaret, thank you so much for joining us on Borrowed today.
Thank you for having me.
So you've got a list of books for our listeners for Earth Day this year, and I'd love if you could tell me about a few of your favorite titles.
Sure. So I have a lot of favorite titles. It was hard for me to put together this list, but one fun thing I thought it would be great to do was reach out to nonprofits working on the front lines of the environmental movement and ask them to provide us with personal recommendations of books that inspired them and would inspire other readers to take climate action. So the first book that I have here is a recommendation from our partner, 350 Brooklyn. The book is Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore by Elizabeth Rush. Rush travels around the United States to the Gulf Coast, Miami, the Bay Area, the Northeast, and our very own New York City, and she reports on the impact of climate change and rising seas on our coastal communities.
That sounds awesome. And what's the next book you have for us?
My next book was recommended by the Jamaica Bay Rockaway Parks Conservancy, who has done incredible work to restore city parkland on the Brooklyn waterfront. Their pick is the 2006 best-selling book by Mark Kurlansky, The Big Oyster. This is a history of New York told through the surprising and entertaining history of the oyster, which once thrived in New York Harbor, but was then tragically wiped out after only 100 years of human intervention.
That's awesome. And I want to mention, too, I was so surprised when I learned that there used to be oysters around Brooklyn's waterways. And is there anything in the book about how they're coming back?
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of work going on right now to restore the oyster beds around New York City. They are really important for filtering our water. So as organizations like Jamaica Bay Rockaway Parks Conservancy, and there's also a great group called the Billion Oyster Project, as they work to restore our oyster beds, we will have cleaner water.
Speaking of the waterfront, I can actually hear the seagulls in your backyard now.
That's true. They're right outside.
You must be right on the water there.
I am right on the water. I live right on Jamaica Bay, which is an area where you can find oyster beds and where they are working very hard to restore.
That is really cool. And do you have one more book for us?
I do. My third and final recommendation is from the NYC chapter of Sunrise Movement, a super energetic youth-led organization fighting for political action on climate change. And the book they chose is titled This is an Uprising, How Nonviolent Revolt is Changing the 21st Century by Paul and Mark Engler. It was published in 2016. So the Engler brothers offer a compelling investigation of nonviolent mobilizations throughout history. This includes environmental movements like Earth First, but they really dive into a whole diversity of movements, and they break down the strategies that led to their successes. And then last thing I should mention is that Sunrise is starting a book club. So listeners that are hungry for reading groups should check out the NYC chapter online. It looks like they have some great titles lined up.
Great. Well, listeners, you can find a whole lot more books that Margaret and these local organizations have chosen, especially for Earth Day, by going to our website, which is bklynlibrary.org/podcasts. Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we we promised you another group storytelling project. So over 3 days, people from all across New York and even out of state contributed one sentence to a growing story.
This one ended up being a little bit dystopian, but we all had fun. And listeners, you can create your own group story to stay connected with your community during lockdown. Check out our website for instructions on how to do just that. And now, here's the story.
Reaching her hand out, as if it could touch beyond the glass pane, Eve thought to herself, wow, it really does look like a giant floating blue marble.
Her throat closed as she felt a sudden, keen pang of just how many years it would be before there was even the chance of seeing her family again. But then Eve breathed in deep, closed her eyes, and tried to focus on the exciting discoveries she would make on the new planet.
Suddenly, Eve's scalp prickled, and as she turned her head slowly, she saw something that shouldn't be this far out.
Feeling the chill of the sterile, recycled air, Eve studied the object on her screen. It looked like an old satellite that had gone dark centuries ago, only with scintillating crystalline protuberances growing out of it.
Could it be? No, Eve thought to herself. It can't. Eve couldn't remember the last time she'd seen something like it. But then, a trickle of fear.
She reached desperately for the controls, trying to contact Mission Base. They needed to know that it was back.
They needed to know that they were trying to invade again. She set her jaw grimly, trying not to think of the last time the Titans came. She opened the communications link, trying to calm the storm in her brain.
But something was wrong with the linkup. When Eve pushed the button, the only sound that came from the panel in front of her was a crackle, and then a long, low beep. She'd have to try reasoning with the Titans directly.
But how? Eve knew that all forms of communication had been tried in those days, when the Titans came and nearly wiped out humanity. But nothing worked, and when the invaders left as suddenly as they arrived, no one left alive knew what they looked like or what they wanted.
But Eve wasn't alive. An advanced AI bot created centuries ago by the very same family she still served. Eve had battled the Titans then, and she would face them again now. She knew what they wanted then, but what if things had changed? Eve clenched her fists as the crystals on the satellite began to glow.
Eve jumped out of her seat and walked towards the escape pod, calculating how quickly she could reach the satellite, and hoping the pod's protective shield would be enough.
Enclosed in a container not much bigger than herself, she exited the relative safety of the ship and entered the true vastness of the universe. The glowing satellite seemed to twist in space towards her.
Then, just as she shifted into cruising speed, Eve saw a flash of green light and the pod halted. A voice, seemingly in her head and yet echoing all around her, boomed a message.
Although crisply audible, the message was utterly incomprehensible to Eve, who could not even discern what language it was in. Nevertheless, it left her with a sinking feeling, a bad omen in an environment lacking gravity, that she should not go on.
Eve had decided to leave Earth in the first place because of its own internal warfare that had emerged after the Titans' departure, and as new societies formed and the competition for resources severed the ties among its people, Eve realized that of all the emotions she had evolved to feel, sadness was the one she could no longer bear. As a centuries-old AI bot, she had become fluent in dozens, if not hundreds, of languages and could communicate with both humans and animals. This being her first language barrier in decades, she wondered if this could be her true mission. Maybe she wasn't escaping Earth. Maybe she was going to finally save it.
Using a cleverly encoded neural network, Eve sat in a paused escape pod and learned the language of the Titans. Finally, she could understand what they had been trying to tell her all along.
A flash of green light again shot forth from the ancient artifact, and the same message Eve had heard before, once incomprehensible, now boomed with astonishing clarity. For the last time, turn off the blinkers of your space station. The neutron rays have been eroding our atmosphere for a millennia.
Either learn how to operate your vehicle property or get out of space. Stunned and still bathed in the green light of the interstellar warning, Eve could perceive a murmur in the distance. Do you think they'll get it this time, Glorbax? If they haven't figured out neural networks by now, then they deserve to be annihilated again. Oh, crap. This was still recording.
Elated at finally decoding the Titan's message, Eve's mood darkened once she realized there was no one left in the station to turn off the blinkers. Her mission to save the few humans left on Earth was futile.
But what if I don't have to save them? Eve thought. They have never treated me as an equal anyway.
And with that, she says to the Titans, I choose option B. Get them out of space! She presses the emergency bomb release button and aims the bomb towards the ship.
As the ship explodes and the blinkers fade away, she rides off into the horizon and thinks to herself, rock and roll never dies.
Adjoa, Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Yesha the Librarian from Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Stephanie, Windsor Terrace, Brooklyn.
Carl Fossum, Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
Hasina from Queens.
Lauren from Greenpoint.
Kat from Red Hook, Brooklyn.
Virginia from Clinton Hill, Brooklyn.
Christopher, Windsor Terrace, Brooklyn.
Rachel Tiemann, South Slope, Brooklyn.
Cassie Hickman, Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Melissa, Kensington, Brooklyn.
Anna Williams, Astoria, Queens.
Becky, Manhattan.
Brenna from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
Zoe Marshall, Soho.
Jamna, Soho, Manhattan.
David Giles, Queens.
Elizabeth Kurth.
Christiana Kurth.
Alexander Kurth, Chelmsford, Massachusetts.
BARD is brought to you by Brooklyn Public Library and is hosted by me, Adjoa Aduse, and Krissa Corbett-Carvores. You can find a transcript of this episode at our website, bklynlibrary.org/podcast.
We'd like to thank Mill Valley Public Library and Austin Public Library, who collaborated in asking their staff and patrons to share their hopes and motivations around climate change. A special shout out to the podcast and climate change project called Borrowed Time, which was started by Andrew Murphy at Mill Valley Public Library. It's a place for public libraries around the country to share what they are doing to act on climate change. You can see what they're up to at borrowed-time.org.
BARD is produced and written by Virginia Marshall with help from Fritzi Bodenheimer, Jennifer Prophet, Meryl Friedman, and Robin Lester Kenton. Our music composer is Billy Libby.
Borrowed will be back in your ears in 2 weeks. Until then, open your windows and give thanks for the outdoors. We'll be getting back out there soon.